Elihu saw a cloud in the distance. He saw a storm was brewing. And in the midst of his speech, he begins to use that visible illustration of God's power and splendor as it's manifest in the lightning and in the thunder, in his power to change the landscape through the wind and water. And he develops his picture of God's majesty through that visible storm approaching on the horizon. But it was no ordinary storm that gathered there on the horizon. They were no ordinary clouds that were laden with electricity. God was there. For we're told in verse 1 of chapter 38, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, out of the storm. God was drawing near in those clouds. He would do so again and again. The people of Israel gathered around Mount Sinai would again be awed by the majesty of God as it was presented to them in the storm clouds, in the thunderings and the lightnings. But this was long before that. Indeed, it may well be the first instance that is ever given of the Lord coming in a kind of a physical way to his people. Those who read these words would have been struck by the presence of God in such awe and majesty. A storm brews on the horizon, and an answer comes to Job. But it's not the answer that was expected. The three friends, looking on as the winds begin to stir up the ashes on which they are sitting, and as the rain begins to fall, and as the lightning brightens their surroundings and sends Job in his misery into stark relief against its background, are expecting at any moment that a lightning bolt would strike their friend dead. They're expecting the justice of God to finally come upon this great sinner who refuses in his arrogance to humble himself before God and continues to proclaim his innocence despite his sufferings, which to them shout loud and clear, "Sinner! Great sinner!" But God doesn't answer in the way that they expect. The thunderings roll, the lightning strikes, but it doesn't strike Job. But neither does Job receive the answer he expects. He has called on God to come and to hear his complaint. He has boasted of how he would stand before him and present his case and plead his innocence and demand an explanation of the living God as to why he would treat him in this way. And God doesn't come to Job and say, "Very well, Job, here's what's happened. Here's the explanation. Here's why this suffering has come into your life. Yes, I vindicate you in your innocence. I acknowledge that you are guiltless before me. You are blameless and upright. You're a man who fears God and shuns evil. I will denounce your friends for their faulty theology and their unjust criticism of you. Job, hear me out. I'll explain everything and satisfy your questions. But God doesn't do that. In fact, God doesn't address the questions at all. It's almost as though God has come to this gathering of people on the ash heap near Job's home and has proceeded to tell them things about himself that they never questioned in the first place. As though he's not really been listening. He's aware that someone has been talking about him, and he comes and enters in on the conversation, but like someone who comes into a room and hears the last sentence and proceeds to enter into the discussion without having heard what's gone before, he almost seems to be completely ignorant of what this is all about. But God has been listening. God has been observing. And we will see that even more clearly next week. He understood the hearts and the minds of those men gathered there on that ash heap. He knows the words that have been spoken. He has heard the arguments. And God speaks and always speaks with purpose. And God gives two speeches here in these closing chapters of the book of Job. The first speech begins there in chapter 38 and goes through to the first verse of chapter 40. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and he says, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And he presents a challenge to Job. Dress for action like a man. Get ready, Job. I want to go 15 rounds with you. Come on, Job. Let's have a wrestling match. It has reminiscences of Jacob, doesn't it? At Bethel, and his night-long wrestling match with the angel of God. That's the kind of picture here that we're intended to receive. Dress for action like a man. Prepare yourself, Job. Now I'm going to question you, and you make it known to me. And what God enters in on is a display of his greatness. He starts off by talking about the world that was created. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Come on, Job, you're getting on in years. You must know and understand these things now. Weren't you there? Didn't you see? Where were you? Someone who can speak so boldly, surely you can answer these questions. You know, don't you, on where, what were its bases sunk and who laid its cornerstone? And Job is beginning to remember who it is that he has been challenging. Job is beginning to remember that he's not just confronting another man. He's not just coming to the gates of the city where the elders gather to pronounce judgment on the cases concerning the citizens. He's not just an equal member of the society coming forward with his complaints, claiming that he has been unjustly treated and seeking recompense. He's beginning to realize that he comes to one who is very different from him, much more powerful than he is, much more wise than he is, much more knowledgeable than he is. Not only did he make the world, but he is the one who sustains the world. He is the one who causes the light to shine. He is the one who keeps the stars in their places and the planets in their orbits. He is the one who directs the rivers. He is the one who brings the clouds and causes them to drop their moisture on the earth, whenever he wants that moisture to fall. Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. You see, it's God who does all of these things. It is God who creates the deserts and the place of fertile valleys and hills. It is God who brings the heat of the sun as well as the freezing cold in the Arctic and Antarctic. It is God who has proportioned the places of the land and who ministers, as it were, his grace to them. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? When famine comes, Job, can you call on the clouds and cause the rain to nourish the earth? Do you direct the prey into the claws of the lion? Do you provide for the raven? He talks about various creatures and asks Job about his understanding of them. Now, we've advanced an awful long way, and some of these questions could be more readily answered now than in Job's day. But you get the idea. Do you know when the mountain goat gives birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? Are you intimately acquainted with the creatures around you, Job, that you understand them fully, even the intimate aspects of their life? Are you so well knowledgeable in these things that these are no puzzles for you? And can you domesticate these creatures? Is the wild ox willing to serve you? You load a manger up with food, but no, the wild ox prefers his freedom even to a manger full of food. Will he plow your fields for you? Can you attach him to your plow? No, you have no authority, you see, Job. These are the things that God is saying. You have no power. You have no authority in this world. You cannot do these things. But implicit in all of this is that God does it. And he does it without effort. God knows that here is one who darkens counsel by words without knowledge. And in all of this, God's power in creating the world and in sustaining the world, God's wisdom in governing the world, is presented to Job in contrast to his own impotence, to his own lack of knowledge and wisdom of the things of the world. And God concludes this first speech and he says to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." And so Job does answer. And he answers in this way: "Who am I? I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Yes, I have spoken. Not once, twice I've spoken, but I will answer no more. I'll proceed no further." What has Job done? Well, what Job has done is that he's realized that he's taken on something more than he can really handle. He's challenged God to a duel. And God has responded and said, "Okay, Job, you want a duel? Prepare yourself like a man, I'm coming." And Job's answer is essentially this: "Look, Lord, I'm sorry. I'm no one really. You know, I'm of small account. And you're such a great and majestic God, powerful and knowledgeable and wise in all your ways. How can I answer you? But, you know, I've said my piece. I'm innocent." You see, Job is fearful of God now. Job recognizes that he's met his match, as it were. Yes, he could stand against his three friends. He could shoot down their arguments. He could demonstrate the folly of their words. Now he stands before a God who is all wise and all powerful. But he still maintains his innocence. He said what he has to say, and he will proceed no further. He's not going to continue his arguments. But neither does he retract what he says. He stands by his innocence, though he's silenced by God's might. And so God proceeds again. And in his second speech from chapter 40 and verse 6 through to the end of chapter 41, God continues to challenge Job. Again, he calls him to action. "Dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" You see, what God is now doing is pointing out to Job that while the sufferings may not have come upon him because of any sin, his response has been wrong. His response to those sufferings have been sinful. Job's three friends were wrong. Their theology told them people sin, they suffer as a result. So whenever they see someone suffering, they think that they must have sinned. And if someone suffers very greatly, they must have sinned very greatly. Now, that is not true. Yes, the wicked will suffer and justice will come to them. But sometimes the wicked prosper for a time. And Job is not suffering because of sin. But his response to the suffering is certainly tainted with sin. "You would even put me in the wrong,"
God says, in order that you might be in the right. You will go so far in order to try and prove and demonstrate your innocence that you're willing to conclude that I am being unjust. Job has charged God with injustice towards him, and God comes to Job to address this particular issue, to make Job mindful of the inappropriateness of his response, of his charge to God, without actually defending himself against the charge. In all of this speech, God doesn't actually say to Job, look, I act in perfect justice all the time, and here's some proof. He doesn't go there at all. He again makes Job aware of Job's weakness. He essentially is saying in this speech, challenging Job to demonstrate Job's own power to wield justice. Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity, he says. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. You see, the irony in all of this is that Job has been calling to God for justice, and at the same time charging God with injustice. Job has been crying out to God to help him, all the time charging God with wronging him. And God basically says to Job, okay, Job, since you know better than I know, since you understand things better than I do, since you're such a just and upright man, deal with it. And then he presents him with two creatures. Because you see, Job has come to understand that he's been rather foolish as a creature challenging the Creator. So God presents him with two creatures. He introduces the first, behold, Behemoth, which I made as I made you. He's saying, I made him at the same time. I made him in the same way. He is a fellow creature as you. Now you demonstrate to me your ability to work in this world by demonstrating to me that you can tame this monster. And then he goes on a little later to talk about another great monster, Leviathan. One's a land creature and the other one's a sea creature. We don't know for sure what these creatures were. The suggestion has been that one might be a hippopotamus and the other a crocodile. I struggle with both of those, I confess, but some very wise commentators have gone down that route and suggested that allowing for sort of poetic words and phrases, but I still struggle to see how a hippopotamus's tail can be swung like a cedar. It's virtually non-existent. And the fact that you can't put a rope around the nose of a crocodile or pierce his jaw with a hook, well, they obviously have never met a crocodile hunter. What are these creatures? In a sense, it doesn't matter. I disagree with those who say they're just mythical creatures. God himself says, I made Behemoth in the same way as I made you. God is stating that these are creatures that Job at least knows of, even if he has not actually seen himself. And they are real creatures. And I think the most likely interpretation is to move away from our present age in history and think that these creatures must necessarily have been ones with which we are familiar, and to consider the possibility that they may now be extinct. For we certainly have a fossil record that would indicate creatures that far more readily meet these descriptions than anything that walks on the earth or swims in the sea today. The point is that Job is completely unable to meet the challenge which God presents. He cannot tame Behemoth. He cannot capture him and use his great strength for his own service. Neither can he do that with Leviathan. These are monsters that are not at Job's beck and call and never will be. They cannot be tamed. And in doing this, God is demonstrating, or at least suggesting, his own power and his own right to govern the world as he wishes to govern it. Job doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the ability to order the events of human history, even the lives of his fellow creatures. He can't do it. And what God is basically saying in this way is, look, Job, who are you who is so lacking in knowledge, so lacking in power, so lacking even in the strength to fully cause the creatures of creation to submit to you? Who are you to question me? Who are you to come and challenge the living God who created the world, who sustains the world, who gives life and sustenance to every creature in the world, who is able to direct even Behemoth and Leviathan in the way that he would go? Who are you to question such a God? And how does Job respond this time? Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. You said, hear and I will speak. I will question you and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Job has seen God. Yes, he's seen the black cloud overhead, and he's heard the thunderings, and he's seen the lightnings, which are all just a hint at the power of God. But more than that, Job has seen God through God's words spoken here in a way that he's never seen him before. God hasn't answered a single question that Job asked. He hadn't answered the question why. God hasn't justified himself. This has happened to you, Job, because God hasn't defended himself. Job, you charged me with injustice. Let me prove my justice. He hasn't said anything of that. All God has done is revealed something to Job of his glory. And in the midst of those words that demonstrate the power and the greatness, the wisdom and the knowledge of God, is a contrast presented. A contrast presented between the might of God and the weakness of man. But something more than that is presented to us here. There is also a contrast presented between the actions of God and the actions of man. Let me illustrate this. Derek Thomas, commenting on this passage, at one point in his commentary, talks about the fact that, you know, if he had his way, it would not have been snowing outside his window at the time, living in Belfast, but that he would have ensured that the weather in the south of Spain would have been the general experience of those living in Belfast. If he could, that's what he would have done. He said, I acknowledge that probably other areas of the world would suffer as a result of the change of climate in Belfast, but that's what I would do if I had the power to do it. Since he doesn't have the power to do it, what does he say he'll do? Well, either I must trust God's superior wisdom or emigrate. Well, in the event, he emigrated. But I think that he continued to trust God. The point is this. If man had control of the rain clouds and of the sun, of the ability to bring droughts or flood, if man was the one who controlled the temperature of this world, it would be chaos. God sovereignly controls all things. Not so that it's great for individuals in particular places, but so that the whole planet functions. If man had his way, it wouldn't. So you see, in the midst of these discussions, God is, to some degree, pointing towards his trustworthiness. He doesn't out and out defend his justice, but he contrasts the world in terms of what man can do and what God can do, and what man would do and what God does do. And Job, I think, begins to understand that. And he begins to realize not only that he made a foolish choice in challenging God, but that he sinned in charging God with injustice against him. God's care of creation, his feeding of the raven, of the lion, of the eagle, his bringing rain and sunshine in its place and in appropriate proportions, is indicative to Job of God's care of him. It doesn't seem like God's caring for him right now, but Job has had his eyes opened to realize that God does have his purposes. He may not give the answers, he may not explain his purposes, but what has happened to Job here is that he has been brought to a point of acknowledging his sin. He repents in dust and ashes. He recognized that he has spoken sinfully to God. He's no longer claiming innocence. Yes, he knows that his sins, in comparison to those of the people around him, didn't fit with the sufferings that he was experiencing in comparison to the lack of suffering of those around him. That he basically would not have agreed with his friends. That's not the point. That's not what Job is repenting of here. What Job is repenting of is the charge that God laid against him at the beginning of this section. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? And Job despises himself for having done so. Job repents in dust and ashes for having impugned the name of a holy God. And Job trusts. A storm blew in upon Job, and God spoke out of the storm, and God answered Job in unexpected ways. But it satisfied him. And when difficulties of one kind or another come into your life, and when you cry out, "Why? Why, Lord? Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening now? Why is this happening in this way? Why?" And God answers you, "Trust me." Will his answer satisfy? After all, what else can you do? Even if you knew the whys, would it make any difference? If Job had known the reason for his sufferings, which we have been given a glimpse of, having been eavesdropping on the conference between God and Satan, we have some understanding of Job's situation that he doesn't have. Now, to some degree it may have helped him to have stood firm and not to have reacted sinfully. But you see, knowing why he was suffering wouldn't have taken the suffering away. And when we ask why, often the only answer that comes from God is a silent one that says, "Trust me. Trust me, the creator of the heavens and the earth. Trust me who put the stars in their place and causes the sun to shine. Trust me who sets the boundaries of the oceans and causes the rain to fall on the mountains and fill the lakes. Trust me who feeds every creature and gives them life. Trust me in the midst of this situation. Trust me that I am just. Trust me that I am wise. Trust me that I am doing what is good, even though it may not seem so to you." God says, "Trust me." Will God's answer satisfy? There was a man who once cried out, "Why?" in the midst of great anguish. I think the cry was for our benefit rather than his own or God's. But that man cried out these words, "My God, My God, why have you forsaken me? That man, of course, was Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the Lord of glory, clothed in our humanity, dying on a Roman cross, bearing the sins of his people, being forsaken by God, and bearing the wrath of a holy Creator. Why? And in a sense, we can sort of hear God's answer, "Trust me," was the answer that he heard, I think, in the Garden of Gethsemane, when he prayed, "Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will." And the Father says, "Trust me." And did the answer satisfy? Well, Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2 tells us that this Jesus, forsaken by God on Calvary, endured the cross, despised its shame for the joy that was set before him. He endured it because it would satisfy him. And indeed, the prophet Isaiah, centuries earlier, tells us this very thing. Out of the anguish, real, genuine anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. Our Saviour trusted the plan of his Holy Father and endured the cross on our behalf, that he might bring salvation to his chosen people. He trusted God that this was the wise way, this was the only way, and he was willing to be forsaken by his Father, enduring such great suffering to redeem a people for himself. And as I previously said, God's dealings with us are in the context of a bigger picture. Yes, it was wicked men who nailed Jesus to a cross, but it was by God's predetermined will and purpose. And we endure suffering for God, for God's purpose, whatever it may be. And the interesting thing in all of this suffering that Job goes through is that good came of it to Job personally. We see it in the words that he speaks even here. You see, while it may not have been the main purpose for Job's suffering brought about refinement. Job's suffering demonstrated to him that despite all his innocence and blamelessness before God, when the things in life really got tough, even upright, godly, blameless Job still had sin in his heart that could raise its ugly head. It refined him. It matured him. Even all this suffering did good for Job, as well as demonstrating God's glory and Satan's deceptiveness. Will God's answer satisfy you? Will it satisfy me when the going gets tough? We must trust him, for he is good.